Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have with me Ed Viola, who is a boat surveyor. Hi, Ed. How are you today?
Doing pretty well, John. How are you?
Yeah, you're looking good too, Ed.
Well, that's nice of you to say that.
One of the things that, a lot of people say, well, what does a boat surveyor have to do with real estate? You know, and I think it's so important that we're surrounded by water, and it's all part of the real estate landscape. But before we get into what a boat surveyor is, what were you doing before being a boat surveyor?
Well, my background was really woodworking. I built furniture. That evolved into doing some cabinetry on boating, and it just seemed to be a natural progression from that.
Really? But, I mean, did it exist? I mean, was surveying out at the time?
Well, I've been at it for about 30 years, and originally on Long Island there were just a couple of old-timers. So, you know, the whole profession was wide open, and I kind of filled the void.
Now, did you come out to the East End, or was it the? Were you born here?
I mean, no, I wasn't born here. I grew up in Queens, and actually, it was a woman that brought me out this way. And
women have that way, don't they?
A woman who is now the mother of my three children.
Oh, fantastic! Hi, woman. What's your wife's name, by the
Christine.
Way? Christine. Hi, Christine. Okay, so now you reside in the North Fork, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Kutchuk.
In Kutchuk. So. So let's get back to that silly question of a boat surveyor. Why do they call you a boat surveyor as compared to a boat inspector or boat checker?
Well, I think it's one and the same. As a surveyor, I am checking on boats. It's just a term that tends to be a little bit more engineering oriented than, just simply checking.
Right. Now, when you look at a boat, do you have a procedure that you go through? I mean, you just don't look at the boat and say, I could do this. And, when I can do it, a boat looks nice, but you'll find things that a lot of people would miss, correct?
Well, hopefully. I mean, that's what I'm hired for. But we tend to follow a checklist. They vary a little bit. It depends on, what works best for you. This is a checklist that I've developed, in 30 years of doing surveying. And
do you have a procedure? Like, do you start from the top of the boat down, or do you work from the
Well, it depends on if the boat's in the water or not.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
So, it depends. Sometimes if a boat is out of the water, yeah, I usually will check the bottom first, underwater gear, and then go through the inside, make sure all systems are up to snuff.
Wow. Is there, and I'm making a generalization, like an owner that has a 46 Bertram, would he be more maintenance conscious as compared to fellow that has a 26-foot boat?
Or an 18-foot whaler.
Or an 18-foot whaler.
I don't think it matters so much about the boat. It's about the person. Some people take care of their things and some don't. And, usually in the course of a survey, you can find that out. The problem with a 46 Bertram, let's say, is there's a lot more systems than on an 18-foot Boston Whaler, so that there's a lot more to take care of, and sometimes it's difficult to do that.
Yeah. The reason I say the Bertram, because I had a friend who had one, and any time I went on it, he was meticulous. Mm-hmm. You have to take your shoes off. You have to go barefoot, even if you had Dockers. He said you still take them off and come barefoot. And he just kept he was always having it buffed, cleaned, the whole nine yards. So.
Right.
But I think that's part of his personality.
I think it is, too. Like I said before, it's more about the people in the boat.
Now, you were saying there's different types of surveyors earlier, that some do yachts, some specialize in smaller boats, some even... Can you tell us about the various aspects of surveying?
Well, there are some surveyors that just do cargo. For example, working out of New York, some of the big container ships that come in, they'll inspect cargo before it's loaded. into a hold. They'll inspect the hold to make sure there's no contamination. You know, I'm talking cargo that might have to do with wheat or, you know, perishable items. And then they'll inspect it later when the ship arrives to make sure there is no damage or contamination. That has a lot to do more with insurance than anything insurance carriers.
How long is that kind of a large cargo ship? It's got to take, what, a couple days to do a survey on that?
Well, it depends on how intense you have to be.
Right.
In some cases, these holes are massive. You know, they're 200 feet long, 100 feet deep, and you've got to check and make sure there's no contamination, rust, leftovers from previous cargo that could be hidden in shelving behind stringers and so on. So, yeah, it does take some time.
The last time we got together, there was you got a phone call. And I recall the who was it from? The president of some sort of organization.
Yeah, a call in.
Right, a call in.
Members club or something.
Yeah, and you told me that the boat that you had inspected had everything looked fine to the last aspect. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was funny. I was anticipating this question.
I couldn't resist.
It was a 29-foot Blackfin, an older boat, 1985, that had been very well maintained mechanically, cosmetically, and so on. And in the last 5 minutes of doing the survey, you know, I was pretty much wrapped up off the boat, had my tools packed up, and I use a mallet and sound out the hull to make sure it's sound. And the transom ended up being mushy.
Now the transom, for a lot of people that they don't know what that is.
The back end of the boat, for the easiest explanation. And then I went back into the boat and found out that the transom actually was holding water. And what happened was a few days later, this gentleman called me, and he was from some Blackfin club or something. And he started complaining about it. I don't even know how he found out that I did what I did. But he was talking about how the Blackfin does not have wood in the transom, so there was no way it would have water in it. Well, he wasn't on the boat.
Right, you were on the boat.
I was on the boat. There was water actually pouring out of the inside of the boat when I was tapping it with a hammer. So
what do you think
it turns out that there was some wood reinforcement, and it was soggy.
How do you think it got in there?
On that particular boat, there are outboard mounted rudders, and there's a lot of stress on rudders when a boat's moving through the water, and they must have gotten loose and let water in.
Uh-huh.
And the wood inside was there to reinforce the transom to support that.
Right. So for the most part, you've never had a problem with anybody, especially a seller, being irate with you.
Well, sellers sometimes don't like surveyors coming into a boat because, you know, it's their pride and joy, and we're hired by a buyer to find problems, and most boats do have problems. I don't think anyone's ever been irate with me because you know, I tend to be a diplomat, and it's how you approach a situation and present it. And,
sure.
You know, if there's a problem with the boat, there's a problem with the boat.
I'm not
making it up. It's,
right.
You know, it's just a question of what it costs to fix and who has to fix it.
To me, it's very similar to the home inspectors that we have out here that come into a house, and buyers are sometimes, the sellers are just unaware that problems exist, and that must be the same with boat owners.
Right.
So, great. Well, you know, it's been fantastic having, I can't believe the time has flown by, but Ed, it's been a wonderful delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with our next guest, Steve Kenny of SRK Pools. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have as my guest, Steve Kenny, the owner of SRK Pool Services. Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, John.
Great. I'm so happy you got here. I understand you had some difficulty, some conundrums getting here with the traffic, but otherwise you're here now. And before we start talking about pools and water quality, did you grow up here?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually was, my family, my mom grew up here.
Okay.
And her father owned the Shea Labatt in East Hampton, which is on Main Street back in the 50s and 60s. So.
Oh, so was the, you mean, the, what's it called again?
The Chez Labatt.
Okay.
The Chez Labatt is a French restaurant on Main Street in East Hampton. And we were always in the food business,
right,
the whole family.
Now, do you have a French background or was it just because?
Half French, yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, cool. So, that's great.
So, yeah, it's
like one of my
Irish. Yeah.
Oh, what a great combo.
Yeah, right.
So
I went to spring school.
And you went to spring. So you know this area quite well and what's going on with the pools. What led you to become one of the top experts on pools?
Oh, nice of you to say that. But I was at the Culinary Institute for many years, for about 2 years.
Oh, you studied
the CIA, yeah.
Wow.
I was in the culinary arts. And I really was a fan of the action or reaction when you're dealing with baking or cooking. And it really fascinated me on how I could actually apply that to water.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been drawn to water. There's something about the water that has this huge, you know, one of the most powerful.
Well, we have plenty of it out here, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But most people don't want to go out there. They want to go in their pool.
Yeah, that's true.
So you started in being a restaurateur or working.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So how does one segue out of one into the...
It was an interesting story. Well, it all started with, I was doing both. I was working in the restaurant business and doing pools. And I was taking care of pools in the during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working with my dad and my two brothers. And then one brother went into law. The other one went into film. My dad slowly retired. And we grew the business together slowly.
Wow.
And it was all of a, you know, Volkswagen Bug with no front seat. And just trying to
is
figure
that
out
all
how to
the poles and what?
Oh, yeah, the poles, and that's all we could afford at the time to keep going and get it going. And
so, was your dad your mentor?
In a way, but not as much so as Jordan Glacier was. He was a distributor, vendor, and every time I had a question, I'd ask him a question, and he'd give me enough information that piqued my interest to look into it more. He never really gave me the answers because he knew, but he didn't really know how to apply it. And I just had this burning desire to figure it out.
Right. And you did.
Oh, yeah. It took 20 years
right.
to figure it out. And
well,
there's no place to ask the questions.
A lot of people aren't aware that chlorine, when they smell that in a pool, that's not really a healthy thing. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, elemental chlorine is an odorless and tasteless compound until it bonds to ammonia or nitrogen. So when you're swimming in a pool and you start to sweat or perspire, that'll bond with chlorine and that'll create chloramines. And that's the byproduct of chlorine. And that's the harmful part of chlorine. And that's what you smell. A lot of people associate that sweet smell of chlorine as a summer, you know, happy days. And this is the way I'm supposed to smell. But in fact, and a lot of people say that, well, there's too much chlorine in the pool. In fact, there's not enough. So we also use chlorine to break that bond between ammonia and chlorine. They call that shocking. And the only way you really can break that bond, and we can get into that a little later, is with ozone. So
chloramines, how are they unhealthy?
Well, they're known to cause asthma in children and to adults as well if you're exposed to it. You'll have cough attacks and you'll burn your eyes, sinus problems, ear infections. It's just an inactive form. It doesn't really kill anything. So in order to get free available chlorine, and that's what you're really looking for is the free available chlorine, you have to break that bond between ammonia and chlorine so it's free and available to fight bacteria. So if it's busy with ammonia, it's never going to be able to do its job. So that's something that it's multifaceted. It's not just one thing. It's just not just chlorine. It's just not pH. It's hard to calcium or alkalinity or microfiltration. They're all of them have an important role for each other and all of them hold hands, so to speak. And so understanding the parameters of what you're working with is just as important as if you were baking in the restaurant. Everything has to have a perfect temperature, a perfect amount of this and that in order to make it perfectly leavened. And that's something that chemistry is all about.
Right. Now, you developed and designed a system, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's that system called?
Well, we call it the Hydrozone 3 system, and it stands for three layers of protection. We use a trace amount of chlorine for bather-to-bather contamination. So if you were swimming in the water and you sneezed or spit, or something else might have happened, at least you're protected for there. So the ozone will actually help to oxidize the bond between ammonia and chlorine. So that little trace amount of chlorine is free and available to fight bacteria. And then we have another part, which is the UV, which will help sanitize the water, which ozone is good at sanitizing, but not as good as UV. So I have all three layers of those, and they all work together, and they all help each other.
Now, is it difficult to find the balance of that, or is it?
No. Once you figure out what you're doing, set it up. I mean, what we're working on now is more of an advanced oxidation system where we're putting the ozone into the UV chamber, and that's creating hydroxyl radicals, and that's a very potent way to kill pesticides and all sorts of things in the water, and sewage treatment plants are using it as well. So there's a lot of we're doing a lot of testing in my shop now for that and understanding.
Chlorine doesn't necessarily kill all the pathogens.
Not at all. Yeah. No, it'll kill germs and prevent athlete's foot and things like that. But it won't kill cryptosporidium, which is our biggest concern in the industry right now.
And what is that?
It's a parasite, and it's become immune to chlorine because we've overused chlorine. I mean, since this, back in the, I guess it was Roosevelt who got came down with polio.
Right.
And they thought that he was, he came down with polio because of chlorine. The story about chlorine is that he was going away in the summer and he came back with polio. So they just attributed it to swimming in a pool. So a lot of the pools were drained back then and they closed all the pools because they thought chlorine was causing this. But in fact, it was the chlorine that's killing polio. So that's what they found, that chlorine was actually killing the polio. So then they brought chlorine back into the industry. And then in the 60s, chlorine just took off. And that was the main source. It was just keep pumping chlorine.
Now,
and it's turned into we've overused chlorine for that reason.
It's not good. It's not really healthy.
It's not healthy. And the problem is that now that parasite is immune to chlorine, and about 20 years ago, there was a symposium that I went to, and all these PhDs were talking about this big problem with cryptosporidium becoming immune to chlorine and how we're going to kill it. And we're there now. Right. This is a big issue.
Now, does your system handle that?
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's CDC approved to actually – ozone is approved by the Center for Disease Control to kill crypto and UV. So either one. I use both because I like to have more than one layer of protection in my water.
Now, you've done some high-end pools. In fact, you did the pool at the Maidstone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this year.
What was the issue there?
Well, the same thing. A lot of the clients that we build the pools for locally are Maidstone members, and they love the water at their homes. They were not happy with the Maidstone water, and a lot of them won't swim there. And they finally all came together, and we got a system installed there, and it took a while because the politics and also getting involved with the health department. It's the first one in all of Long Island to have ozone and UV, so that was a big accomplishment to get that knocked out. And there's a lot of learning going on.
I used to be on the harbor committee, and one of the things that they were always promoting was to go with salt water. But salt water is not necessarily the salt water we think that's from the ocean.
No.
It's actually salts.
And salt has a lot of high the total dissolved solids in saltwater pools are very high for if it's coming from the ocean, like a Gurney's type of thing. But a regular sodium salt pool that that we're talking about in the industry is taking electrolysis and sending the electrolysis into the water and charging the particles of salt into sodium hypochlorite, which is still shock. It's liquid shock.
Right.
So it's a high
different
pH.
Form.
Right. And then you start playing with the index and water's ability to scale and corrode. And that's a very, very important part of this whole equation. And that's why I came up with the Hydrozone 3 systems.
Right. Well, how can people get information on SRK Pool Services?
Well, that's the website's being worked on now. We have a website that's a static page for now because we're reinventing our
And what is that?
It's srkpools.com.
Oh.
It's Modern Pool Solutions.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yep. Well, Steve, it's been a delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher. We'll be right back with my next guest, Shah Galani, Fox TV business personality. Welcome back. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and today I have as my guest Shah Galani, who is a Fox TV business personality. Hey, Shah, how are you today?
Great, John. How are you doing?
I'm so happy to see you. You know, it's always great having you on the program.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Right. Likewise. Shah, Larry Kudlow recently said that we're at the beginning of a boom for the economy, citing low unemployment, growth of the GDP close to 3%. Underemployment at an all-time low, and he thinks this upward spiral will continue at least for the next couple of years. So tell us, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I would like to wish Larry a speedy recovery from his
recent
heart attack.
Right.
But yes, Larry's a great guy, and he's got a great read on the economy. I think he's absolutely right. He's hit it, hit the nail on the head. The economy has a great degree of expansion left in it still, And I think that the tax cuts are certainly going to enhance that. And I think what's going to happen, hopefully, with perhaps North Korea's disarmament, with some of the other prospects globally, I think the economy, the domestic economy, is looking good. The dollar is rising, and I think that's going to attract more capital into the U.S. That's going to aid the market. It's going to aid the economy. So I think he's quite correct. I think we got some, you know, green lights ahead of us, probably for several quarters, if not in a few years.
You know, it's kind of interesting what you say, because just, you know, everybody has a different take. And I just saw, what's his name, Paul Jones of...
Paul Tudor Jones?
Yes, Tudor. Right. Yes. Thank you very much, at Tudor Investments. And he was saying that he thinks that we're just going to be in a lull right now for the summer. And then at the end, towards the end of the year, it's really, it's going to leap. The market's going to leap.
Yeah, I think he's probably correct. The market traditionally, you know, does slow down a bit in the summer. A lot of hedge fund guys, a lot of traders take the summer off. And
where do they go?
They're actually right around us here for the most part, and the south
just
of France.
Just being facetious.
but yeah, there's, you know, things slow down. Volume slows down traditionally in the summertime. Doesn't mean there isn't activity. It doesn't mean there can't be a summer rally. And there, we've seen them over the last several summers where we've had some strong upside in the market. So we certainly have that perhaps to look forward to. But I think, agreeing with Mr. Jones, that the fall, the prospects for the fall are pretty good.
Interesting. Now, you had mentioned that you also think globally, and one of the things that I keep seeing is that the global market is not on the uptick, so to speak, as the U.S. economy. Is that because of the situations, the political ramifications, like Turkey and also Italy?
Pretty decent synchronous growth for the last 2 years, and we've only seen some divergence in the last quarter, perhaps moving on to two quarters now. And you're quite correct. Now, that is because of what's happened in Italy, you know, with the league and the five-star movement and the prospects for their Euroscepticism growing. You know, granted, they've come out and said the markets were indeed in a bit of a tizzy when they came together as a coalition, and we had some hijinks over there, and that's calmed down. The markets have calmed down with it, but the two parties, the coalition parties now in government, controlling the government, are Eurosceptics, and so there's still a lot left to be had, to be seen in Europe, and that's going to create some divergence. Part of what we've seen as a result of that is the euro has fallen, starting to climb back up, but the dollar strengthened against the euro. So again, the capital seems to be moving towards the United States and away from Europe because of that divergence. European banks aren't as strong as the U.S. banks. You know, the U.S. banks did a great job in spite of the financial crisis and, you know, their participation in causing that. They've been cleaned up very well, and the European banks have not been. You know, Deutsche Bank is probably, you know, a prime example, number one. That bank probably has to be rescued. But so there is some fear that European banks, the ability to raise capital is a problem. And so in terms of European economies, that's part of the divergence. Emerging markets have also been diverging a little bit. They've been slowing down a little bit. So U.S. remains, the once again, the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry, if you will.
Right. That's good. I like that. One of the things you had mentioned is that the political atmosphere seems to affect the market, especially in Europe, whereby here, for example, the summit with North Korea, which is very positive, the market hasn't been responding, or has it been responding to that? It seems like the market doesn't pay attention to what's happening to the news, or is that just my take of it?
It certainly does pay attention to the news, and certainly does pay attention to politics. But part of the problem there is, you know, the politics have been like watching a bouncing rubber ball. And in terms of the president, Trump, sometimes things are positive, and the next moment he, you know, kind of walks them back. And I think in terms of North Korea, the future remains to be seen. So yes, there's a lot of positiveness that came out of the meeting. I think it was a great summit. I think it bodes very well. Let's just keep our fingers crossed that it continues in the direction it has hopefully started in.
Yes, let's hope so. So for the first time, American wealth has surpassed the $100 trillion mark in the early part of this year. Though the stock market was driving in the first quarter, home prices were rising to offset this hit. So do you think people are putting their money more so in real estate than in the market now?
No, I don't think so. I think we did see some significant outflows of from domestic ETFs and domestic mutual funds in the first quarter, and I think February obviously was a bit of a tumultuous proposition for investors, so they fled and they continued throughout the first quarter. We're starting to see them come back, so I think that the prospects for the market are better than they are for real estate. Real estate has gone significantly higher, and partly because there is a lack of inventory. So, as you know, there's without that kind of inventory, filling out the marketplace, it's a seller's market, and buyers are scrambling to take whatever they can at the offer price and paying above that. So I think that market's going to continue. I don't think that really speaks to the economy doing anything other than progressing, that consumers have money, that capital is available, rates remain low, mortgage rates really traditionally remain low. And so the market, I think the real estate market, it bodes well for the real estate market. At the same time, that's also a vote of confidence in the economy, which is good for the stock market.
Right. Makes sense. Now we have, I was reading about these groups of Chinese coming in and buying sections of cities, like especially in Canada, they're buying large real estate tracts. And this is causing the housing market there to rise exponentially. These cities are now enacting surcharges on the foreign buyers to slow down this rise. So my question is China doing so well or conversely so badly that the Chinese need to put their money in something more stable like the real estate market?
Well, yeah, I'd say it's perhaps a bit of both, but in the sense of doing well, the Chinese economy obviously has been doing exceptionally well. I think economic growth, the GDP growth there, is still above 6%. It's calmed down a little bit from being closer to 8% and then falling to 7.5%. But I think the future bodes well for the Chinese economy in terms of GDP growth. The Chinese have a tremendous savings rate. It is probably the greatest savings rate in all over the world. It's probably close to 20%. So with that kind of savings rate, they're always looking to apply their savings, and real estate is always a great investment. It's also the Chinese, there's a lot of restrictions in the Chinese economy. There's a lot of restrictions in terms of getting capital out of the country. So a lot of Chinese, when they can, when there's an opportunity to buy property elsewhere, they're going to do it. It's a great investment, especially in Canada, obviously the United States. So they're going to continue to buy real estate internationally. And I think that's just a sign of the strengthening Chinese economy and also their desire to diversify themselves out of Chinese assets.
We're running out of time, but I know you have a subscription service. Do you want to talk just how does one get in touch with you? How does one get a hold of your subscription, where you give this kind of advice, obviously?
Well, I have we call a blog. It's a little bit more than that. It's more like an e-letter that's published twice a week, and that's Wall Street Insights and Indictments.com. A lot of information there about the market, about the economy. I do also recommend stocks pretty regularly in those columns and give a lot of advice in terms of what to look out for if markets look to be a little weak here and there. So that's a fun place for your viewers and listeners to catch up on what's going on.
Shah Galani, it's been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.